In today's episode, we'll be talking about the history of beer in Ann Arbor with author David Bardalis. A year ago, he released a book called Ann Arbor Beer, A Hoppy History of Tree Town Brewing. He's also the resident beer expert at the Ann Arbor News and a frequent contributor to the Great Lakes Brewing News and the Michigan Beer Guide. You can also check out his blog at annarborbeer.com. I've spoken to David a few times. He's a great personality, great person to talk to, and we'll have a lot of great stories about the history of beer in Ann Arbor and how those things have carried over to the present. Welcome to the podcast, David Bardalis.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Great. So you are our resident beer expert here in Ann Arbor, the preeminent author, preeminent writer, the Ann Arbor News beer historian. You continue to write for them as well as a number of publications, correct?
That's correct.
Excellent. So what I'd like to do is have a great talk about the history of beer in Ann Arbor, how that delicious liquid has changed the face of our town throughout history, and talk a little bit about contemporary, what Ann Arbor's like now with beer. So to kick things off, can you tell us a little bit about the history of beer in Ann Arbor, the history maybe of spirits in Ann Arbor from when the town was first founded?
Yeah, sure. Going back to the town's founding, which was 1824, as anybody who goes downtown and sees the Village of Ann Arbor boundary signs knows, spirits were really more of the rage in the country as a whole, and whiskey in particular, because it was just, it's probably not like the fine whiskeys that you are accustomed to drinking today, Rich, but it was easier for these pioneering rugged people to actually make, to distill, and brewing. Although there was brewing, they didn't even know what yeast was, and so they didn't exactly brew really good beer. They still, if anybody wanted good beer, it was imported from England mostly, and only rich people could afford that. So the everyman's drink was whiskey, and Washtenaw County was awash in the stuff, just like pretty much the entire country. And in fact, the roots of Prohibition go all the way back to this time, due to the alarming consumption of whiskey by man, woman, and child. The Prohibitionists got their start railing against, you know, drunkenness all the time. And it was so ingrained in the culture, though, that at the time they had barn raisings. You know, a family would settle upon a plot of land, and then the neighbors would come around for miles and help them erect their dwelling or their barn or whatever. And the customary payment for that was, you know, gallons of whiskey. So the first Prohibitionists who railed against the use of whiskey pretty much for every occasion, and including that one, convinced a couple families. There's one I highlight in my book. The name of the gentleman escapes me, but he told everyone, you know, I'm going to have the barn raising, but I'm only going to give you water. You know, I'm not going to serve whiskey. I'm a Prohibitionist. Yeah, we're not going to do that. Well, they didn't call themselves that. He was a temperance man. And the response to that was just like, that will never work. No one is going to come and help you. But they did, you know, they were a little upset about it, but they did come and help him. And anyway, that was the culture of the time before beer took hold, which happened a little later.
Yeah, I'd say nothing like a good gallon of whiskey during a hard working day out in the sun, right?
Yeah, I don't know how many of these barns still stand or how long they did stand after the drunks put them up.
But that's a good statistic. pulling from your book, again, I'll give the title of the book again. It's Ann Arbor Beer, A Hoppy History of Tree Town Brewing. So you can get copies at the library or at any literati.
Available at every fine bookstore in the area, and also from the author himself.
It's a great read. And there are lots of great little facts that I pulled out. I won't ask you to do that right now. But one of them that was really cool was that Washtenaw County's first ever court session, January 15th, 1827, pretty early in the founding, was to approve the application for license to retail strong and spirituous liquors. So in your book, you say whiskey was used a lot for bartering, a lot for, like you said, bribery a little bit to get people to.
Yeah, it was essentially a form of currency.
And so then how, you mentioned that just making beer, brewing beer was in its infancy here. Can we take a step back and talk about maybe the U.S., how sort of the beer barons started and how this trickled into our fine town?
Well, sure. The beer barons really came later in the 19th century with the invention of modern rail and refrigerated, artificial refrigeration.
That's why you're the historian.
Yeah. If you want to go back further than that, like I said, the history of brewing is, there's more of it, obviously, in the East Coast and New England, where, you know, the more of the English settlers were and everything, and it worked its way inland from there. But they also drank all sorts of bizarre drinks that I've read in various books. You know, one was called Flip, and it involved, I don't even remember what it was in it, but it was nothing you'd want to drink today, and it involved heating it with, by, you know, putting a red hot poker in it and stirring it and stuff like that. They probably just plucked it straight out of the fire to do that, so you might have got a little ash in there too. But the beer barons really arose in the 19th century, and I assume by beer barons we're talking about Anheuser-Busch.
Yeah, Adolphus Busch.
Adolphus Busch and, you know, Miller and Stroh's and those guys. And, of course, before we even get into that, a key ingredient, and this was especially important in Ann Arbor and Washtenaw in general, was Germans. You had to have Germans.
Yeah, any good beer has a German in it.
Yeah, well, where there's Germans, there's beer. And they brought with them the style called lager, which is at one point was all pretty much you could get in America for the longest time after this took off. All the earlier kind of weird, sour-tasting, unsanitary beers we were talking about would have been ales from England. And, of course, we don't need to get into the technical details of that unless you want to, but most people probably listening to this already have an idea. It has to do with the type of yeast you use and how they ferment.
I'm assuming there were a decent number of German immigrants into the area.
Very much so. And the proof is all around us today. You know, German names are on everything. Some of the businesses originally founded by Germans, you know, there's still a couple on Main Street, I think, 100-year-old businesses and whatnot. Vogel Keys. These Germans came to, there was strife it wasn't Germany at that time, it wasn't unified, but they had different states like Prussia and Württemberg, and all the immigrants fleeing the strife ended up in America, in the Midwest a lot, it seems like, you know, as Wisconsinites can attest to as well, they had their share of Germans. But many came to Ann Arbor and surrounding areas for various reasons that are probably best asked of the local German clubs today. Maybe they have family letters and whatnot that I don't have access to. But German immigration here lasted almost 100 years, starting around 1830 and going right up into the 20th century. And, yeah, so they brought with them the knowledge and the thirst for beer.
Yeah, they missed their homeland mostly with some of it.
They did, and they brought the first lagers to Ann Arbor, starting sometime around the 1850s, as near as I can kind of pinpoint it. And nobody even knows. More serious historians than I don't even know exactly when the first lager was brewed in America. They think it's around 1840. In Philadelphia, but there's some dispute about that anyway.
Gotcha. So the immigrants came and they brought with them their culture, their cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And so did a lot of that brewing, was it for personal use and then it kind of morphed into more of the more commercial or?
I think they set about creating commercial ventures pretty much right out of the gate. The first commercial brewery in Ann Arbor was established in 1838, although I believe that was more of an English kind of a brewery at the time. But as soon as the Germans started appearing, they pretty much ran the English style breweries out of business in short order. So I'm sure they also did what we'd call home brewing today as well. But I think they didn't waste any time building breweries either.
So then, how did the geographically in Ann Arbor, do you know where some of this started to happen? Or I know there was also a pretty decent growth of breweries in Ipsy as well, in Ypsilanti. How did this kind of build up, or where were some of these clustered?
I guess more downtown. They're really kind of scattered around, and you can see the buildings today, which, you know, we can probably talk about that a bit too. But the main part of town is what we call the Old West Side today, was where the Germans mostly, they kind of founded that end of town. So they built the building that Grizzly Peak is in today. They built the where the Earl is, that used to be a hotel that the Germans ran, and kind of that whole end of town, really. So a little further west, if you travel, this is actually right across the street from where I live, near the Argus building, which most Ann Arborites will know what that is one of the earlier breweries. It started life as called the Western Brewery, founded by Peter Brame, whose house also still stands on Liberty Street. It's office space now, but Peter Brame was one of first, B-R-E-H-M. He was one of what I call Ann Arbor's beer baronets, because they never really achieved the world dominance of certain other breweries, but they were big players and pioneers in Ann Arbor. So his brewery was out on the west side, and then another one was just around the corner at what is now the Cavern Club and Circus and Millennium Nightclub building. And there was some dispute about whether that was actually, that the building that stands there now was used as a brewery or if it came later. I read conflicting reports on that, but in any case, the lagering caves are what the Cavern Club is. If you've ever been in that building, yeah, and seen those caves, that's what it was used for originally, was to store beer.
Cool. Were there any features specifically in Ann Arbor that helped breweries? So for instance, in your book, you talk about water as mm-hmm. a specific ingredient.
Yep.
Was there anything in particular that made Michigan, or pardon me, Ann Arbor special?
Well, in pre-refrigeration days, it probably helped that they had a lot of cold to work with during a good chunk of the year, and then a lot of ice to harvest in the spring and to store in ice houses and use throughout the warm months as they need it. Because, I mean, we take it for granted, you know, you just throw your beer in the fridge and then voila, the mountains turn blue, you know, oh, must be time to drink it. But back before there was any refrigeration, they had to use ice, which was really hard in the summer because they couldn't make it. So I think that helped. Obviously, Michigan is the water wonderland. What used to be Allen Creek, in fact, is where that Western Brewery was founded. It's where kind of where the Bach Elementary School is now. Allen Creek is now an underground trickle, but it used to be above ground and it used to have flowing water in it. And the breweries used it for various things, including, you know, using the cool water to keep the beer cold. So those things helped. And then lots of fellow Germans to buy the beer when it was made, you know, can't make it and not sell it and stay in business. So
as beer kind of grew and mixed in with the whiskey and Ann Arbor became what it was starting to head towards, how did the people here who were maybe not so crazy about whiskey, how did they feel about a new alcoholic beverage on the scene?
Well, it's interesting because even to this day, brewers market beer as sort of the beverage of temperance because it's lower in alcohol. I mean, yeah, primarily that's it. So you can drink beer without, I mean, well, today we have higher strength beers, but they still don't really approach whiskey. So that was sort of the tack that was taken as Prohibition gained momentum, which really built up ahead. I mean, we just think it kind of suddenly happened in the early 20th century, but it was 100 years in the making. And so at the time, and then beer really, the way whiskey was ingrained in the native culture, so to speak, when Germans came over, beer was so ingrained in their culture the way whiskey was here. You know, it was like, you know, every wedding, you know, you drank beer. Oktoberfest started that famously, you know. They signed contracts, you know, and instead of a handshake, they'd have a beer together or whatever. It was really part of their culture. So the Germans would see an attack on beer as part of the Prohibition effort as also an attack on their culture, and they fought it tooth and nail and successfully held it off for a long time, but obviously we know how it ended.
So now we're coming into the, let's say we're into the late 1800s, maybe before that. You're the historian. How did the University of Michigan factor into this being right from the beginning kind of a big part of Ann Arbor? And just knowing some of the, reading your book and spoiler alert, some of that impact on Prohibition in, let's say, Washtenaw County, but just drinking norms.
The university has an interesting role. The first president, Tappan, was not really a teetotaler, but members of the Board of Regents were. And he was ousted in part, despite taking the University of Michigan from its humble beginnings as basically an insignificant little cowtown school into being well-regarded and known for research and how it got its reputation that it continues to have today. That wasn't enough, though, because, darn it, he drank wine with his dinners, and he just didn't mind if students drank beer, you know. He thought they should be responsible for themselves, you know, a crazy thought. And obviously he cautioned against, you know, drunken indiscretions and, you know, property damage and all the things that, you know, young, crazy, drunk people may be known for. You know, he believed they should be accountable for their actions, but otherwise he didn't think a universal ban against, you know, beer was something that was useful. So he was in part ousted from his seat as the first president at the university. And through the years, there's some stories in the book, of course, that I've recounted about drunken student misbehavior and whatnot. And it seemed like in the early years, pretty much up until the early 20th century, the university was kind of a freewheeling sort of hands-off approach towards student drinking and whatnot. And then as the prohibitionists gained more and more influence, the university did get visitors from the capital city in Lansing, little politicians coming in to survey the landscape, and, you know, there'd be all these drunk kids swinging from lampshades, you know, from chandeliers in the bars and whatnot. And basically it took them being embarrassed by that sort of behavior to finally start reining some of that in, or trying to, which, you know, I would argue laws don't really necessarily change people's behavior. They just divert it in other ways. But so Ann Arbor became a dry town, largely. There was always kind of an informal agreement between the university and the city that there wouldn't be any alcoholic establishments in an area around the campus, and that persisted into the 1960s. But even that finally broke down. But for a while, Ann Arbor was actually officially dry.
Yeah, in your book, it was interesting to learn about that boundary. So there was space between the campus, mm-hmm. and how that shrunk or morphed as the years went by. I think, was it Ashley's is the closest, or was the closest?
Right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would think that's, then you have all the bars on South U, but it depends on where you want to measure the true heart of campus. But Ashley's started, actually, I think they were the only establishment on that stretch of State Street that had a liquor license. So they had a nice little start there.
So looking at, again, with some of the dates, it looked like Michigan went dry. Was it Michigan went dry a year and a half before Prohibition?
Michigan was interestingly dry for about 25 years in the 19th century, but nobody paid any attention whatsoever to that to that little detail. And then, yes, in the modern era of Prohibition, Michigan went dry a full year before the national Prohibition laws were passed. So... wah, wah.
Yeah, I have the stats here that, let's see here, 3,285 Michigan saloons. David's crying right now. 62 breweries, 2 distilleries in the state of Michigan were shuttered. So
I feel like Bluto when they dropped the whiskey and they were emptying out the Delta House, smashed the bottle. And he...
So that effectively ended the legal consumption and sale of spirits and beer.
Yes, for that first year when Michigan was dry and Ohio was not, we actually had to turn to our neighbors to the south to help supply us. And Michigan, the state of Michigan, was so determined to enforce prevent people from going to Ohio, buying up, you know, carloads of everything and driving it back, that they had police on the freeways or whatever passed for freeways back then, trying to, you know, interdict people from doing that and shooting at them when they didn't comply, which, you know, to me sounds a little silly, but, you know, that's where the logic of Prohibition leads.
So then during Prohibition itself, did Ann Arbor play any role in some of the, I mean, its proximity to Canada, proximity to, let's say, Chicago, did it play any role in kind of the illicit trade in spirits or beer?
I don't know about a role. It was certainly a stop on the way from Detroit to Chicago. I was a little disappointed in our fellow Ann Arborite Ken Burns' series on Prohibition, in that historians know well that much of the alcohol that was illegally brought into the country came through Windsor and Detroit. And yet, Detroit merited hardly any mention in his series, and New York got all the attention, so boo for that. But yeah, so with all that coming through Windsor, Detroit, they called it the Windsor, Detroit funnel. Some of that got dropped off in Ann Arbor on the way to Chicago and further points west, certainly. And of course, we had, like anywhere else, there were local entrepreneurs here as well, setting up their own distillery operations. And you could argue that the real birth of home brewing in Ann Arbor started around this time too. It was so open that there were articles in the Ann Arbor News' forerunner of the time about, you know, asking people, do you have a brewery at home? Here's some helpful hints, you know.
So, fast forwarding. Hey, Prohibition's over. Congratulations.
Yay. I'm glad we can just skip ahead like that.
How did Ann Arbor bounce back? So I'm not sure if that decimated, kind of Ann Arbor had to start over again.
Yes. In the commercial sense, certainly, the legitimate commercial sense, there were all the illegal breweries and whatnot were probably somewhere out in the countryside, as you can imagine, where they wouldn't be easily visible. But yeah, Ann Arbor is like any place else. The drinking did continue here. The exact details of that would require a lot more digging since, you know, bootleggers tended not to leave good public records behind them. But yeah, all the commercial breweries, when we had about five or six of them in the 19th century, mostly German run, they if they hadn't already gone out of business before, which some of them did, then Prohibition killed them for sure in Michigan. So the one that came back was sort of the descendant of the one I mentioned that's near the Argus building. It's actually the Offices of Mathematical Reviews now. And that brewery was started back up by, if I recall correctly, a couple investors from Chicago came in and kick-started that, and they called it the Ann Arbor Brewing Company. And they built the building that's there right now that Mathematical Reviews is in around 1902. So, yeah, the building's still there, but it's offices. However, I was able to go in there, and Norm Reichert, who's an editor at Mathematical Reviews, maintains a little kind of like shrine to the building's history in his office. So he's got some of the old bottles from back in the day, and he took me down to show me the lagering caves too, which is just, you know, a big empty space right now. They haven't figured out how to use it, but it's still there. And that restarted, and around, I don't remember the exact year, but it was shortly after Prohibition ended, so let's say 35, and it made it to about 1949, when the larger regional breweries like Stroh's and, you know, the Milwaukee Boys and everything kind of took over the scene for various, you know, social and economic and political reasons, mostly economic. But the funny thing about the Ann Arbor Brewing Company post-Prohibition was that it made several different brands, but various sources say that they were all the same brand and they just had different labels that they put on the bottles depending on what you ordered.
That's a good marketing ploy.
Yeah, I don't think you could get away with that today.
Probably not. So as we get into more of the modern, let's say the modern area of Ann Arbor, microbreweries, how did that trend start up again, or when do we start to get to where we are today?
Ann Arbor was pretty much a pioneer. Well, I should back up a bit. So when the Ann Arbor Brewing Company closed in 1949, there was no more commercial brewing in this city until 1995, when Matt and Renee Greff opened the Arbor Brew Pub. And Grizzly Peak followed about a month later. So that, yeah, it was in the summer of 95, summer, fall. And Ann Arbor's actually got a little bit of a history here with changing the law in Michigan so that brew pubs would be allowed. For a while, they just weren't even legal. You couldn't do what brew pubs do today, which is brew beer and serve it on premise. There was pretty much one type of license, the brewery license. And you had to have a lot of money behind you and, you know, big plans and all that in order to be a brewery. But, you know, if you just wanted to kind of have a little system and brew some, you know, beer and serve it to your restaurant patrons, you couldn't do that. You know, it was too cost prohibitive. So that started in California, these brew pub establishments. And so a guy named Barry Seifer, who was actually the founder of Grizzly Peak. He moved here from Berkeley, and he named Grizzly Peak after a road out there, which I guess is quite famous, but I don't really know very much about Berkeley. And there's a whole lot of other people who are involved in the effort, but he was involved in the effort to get Michigan to pass a law allowing brew pubs. And then he got Grizzly Peak started, and he had to drop out for various reasons. And then, the current ownership took over today. But yeah, Barry was instrumental in getting that passed, and he's still in Ann Arbor, and he actually works in one of the old brewery buildings right now. Total different field, though.
Cool. So you're pretty good friends with Renee and Matt.
I've heard of them.
So can you tell me about them being one of the pioneers? How did they set up shop? How did they start? And then we can talk about kind of the evolution of them as a case study.
At the time Matt and Renee and Grizzly Peak got going, they were among the first in the state. There was a traffic jam in Snug in Detroit, and then I think there was a place in Grand Rapids, and then they were like the third and the fourth brew point pubs in the whole state, I think. Somebody might dispute that with better numbers, but that's what I recall. Matt and Renee, Matt had some soul-sucking corporate job that he refuses to really discuss much to this day, and he was miserable, so, you know, being married yourself, that if your spouse is miserable, you're miserable. So, you know, he liked to homebrew, and you know, Renee encouraged him to you know, quit a soul-sucking job and, you know, let's open a brew pub. And so they didn't know what they were doing, as they admitted at first. And any older Ann Arbor residents who were around there at the beginning can attest to, they made a lot of mistakes. It's really a lot of funny stories, but that's really for them to tell, not me. And you can read about some of them in the book, of course, including how Sacred Cow IPA got its name, which is one of my favorite stories. But they struggled for a few years. They were teetered on the edge of bankruptcy and wanted to throw in the towel at one point until their attorney came to them and said, you'll basically be paying off your investors the rest of your life if you declare bankruptcy. And so they decided, all right, well, we just have to make this work. And they did. And here we are nearly 20 years later, and they're, you know, they distribute bottles. You know, their bottled beer is distributed statewide. You know, I go up in Traverse City, and it's on tap up there. Haven't gone as far as the UP to see if they make it up there, but I bet they do. And they're well-respected, not just as members of the community and as brewers, you know, but just all around what they've been able to accomplish has been pretty impressive.
So we've got those two, and then we've got some other places that have popped up in the last decade or so. Wolverine State Brewing Company is one.
Mm-hmm,
who are some others that have kind of pulled up in the microbrewery scene locally that you've talked to?
Wolverine was started in about 2010, although the beer had been brewed before that and was available in stores, but it was brewed, contract brewed, by the now defunct Michigan Brewing Company out in Weberville. They got their building, which was the, you know, former Big George's scratch and dent warehouse or something like that, and they opened in late 2010, and they've expanded several times since then, and going back to our good German roots, most small breweries make ales because you can produce them faster and thus sell them faster. But Wolverine took a different tack, and they make lagers, which take a longer time. They have to tie up your tank sitting there maturing over months instead of weeks like ales. And they've done a great job making those lagers, all lagers. And they are probably, to this day, one of the only ones in the country, microbreweries, that is, that does lagers, exclusively lagers, I should say. And the microbrewed lagers are starting to get more attention. I read something in, I don't know if it was the New York Times or one of those newspapers out east. And, you know, it's not an official trend until someone in New York notices it. And so New York noticed it. And so maybe there'll be more lager microbreweries as a result. We'll see. Jolly Pumpkin, it's not actually brewed in Ann Arbor, but it is brewed just down the road in Dexter and served in the Jolly Pumpkin Cafe in Ann Arbor. And at the time Ron Jeffries started that with his wife Lori in 2004, he makes Belgian-style sour ales, which they're again now come on strong. But in 2004, nobody knew what to make of them, and many people. Ron says he still gets this occasionally today, but not as much as he used to. Some people would call him up and say, hey, I got some of your beer, and there's something wrong with it. It's bad. But now tastes have changed, and I think people they've embraced Ron's beers to the point when, again, going back to the New York Times in 2010, wine critic Eric Asimov Empaneled a group of blind tasters to decide what was the best Belgian or Belgian-style beer. They had actual Belgian beers from Belgium and things produced here as well. And again, it was a blind taste, and Ron's beer, his Golden Ale, Oro de Calabaza, was named the best by the panel. That got him some attention.
Impressive. Well, it was New York, so
it was New York, so you know. It's official now. What do we know here in Michigan?
So talking about a lot of the entrepreneurs, it sounds like start as homebrewers themselves. And I know just through family and friends, there's a big homebrew culture that exists here in Ann Arbor. Can you talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah. Ann Arbor is also home to the state's, as far as I know, the state's oldest official homebrewing club, the Ann Arbor Brewers Guild. That was founded in 1986 by Jeff Renner, Rolf, and I'm going to mangle his name, so if you're listening, Rolf, I'm sorry, Wuchurer, and Wuchurer, I don't know. It's spelled like W-C-H-E-R-E-R. It's one of those German things I'm going to stumble over, so apologies, Rolf, and several other people. And it's going strong to this day. It's got maybe over 200 members, I want to say, and they adhere to the old ways, even though this club is so large, they still host their meetings at different members' houses. And I've been to these meetings, and they are huge, but they pull it off somehow. And they refuse to elect presidents and treasurers and have offices. It's just kind of an anarchic thing, but it works. And it continues to grow to this day. That said, they do have an able-bodied leader in the form of Chris Fry, who likes to call himself the chief anarchist or benevolent dictator. So he helps impose a little bit of order onto the chaos. But Ann Arbor's homebrewers have also been influential across the state and even the country. Chris sits on the national governing board for the American Homebrewers Association. Jeff Renner, one of the founders, who's still homebrews and is around in town, is almost single-handedly, he would insist on the almost, responsible for bringing back a dead style of beer that was called the classic American Pilsner, or it's sometimes called the pre-prohibition Pilsner. And Jeff remembered that beer from his youth, from a long time ago, and he didn't know why no one made one anymore, and he just... You know, he'd brew it and he'd bang the drum to anyone who'd listen, you know, like, this is a great style and, you know, here's how you make it. And he'd write articles in magazines. And so now the you know, I forget what year, but finally it was re-recognized as a style and put in the Beer Judges Certification Program Guidelines, Classic American Pilsner. So you can look it up today. And that's really thanks a lot to Jeff Renner of Ann Arbor, not New York.
So you've already mentioned a few of the buildings that have existed that housed breweries or were part of this whole tale. For the architectural enthusiasts out there, what are some of the spots that they can check out, even just exteriors of today, other buildings that we haven't talked about that are just a neat thing that Ann Arbor, because we talked about this, a lot of them still stand today. They're not the barns that were raised on whiskey, but these are right. Brick and mortar. So what are a few of the others that you've been to that are neat to check out?
Yeah, so there are several, and if I ever get off my butt, I would like to create some kind of a regular walking tour for people, or at least write a pamphlet or something so people can check them out for themselves. I mentioned the building on it's actually on 4th Street, not Avenue, 4th Street on the Old West Side, off of between Liberty and William, the Mathematical Reviews building. Please do not just go in there and ask for beer or anything. It's a working office. But it is still there. You can see this building. It's a three-story brick building, and it was one of the original breweries. It was the one that operated after Prohibition as well. The Cavern Club / Millennium / Circus.
Yeah, Circus.
That, again, it may not be the original building, but it's the original site of one of the breweries. That was the City Brewery. And then there is one on North 5th Street, kind of up toward, once you get up toward the Gandhi Dancer and that part of town. It's called the Old Brewery Apartments, and it's covered in ivy today. And it's all, you know, housing, but that was one of the original breweries as well, still standing. And then a little further north of town on Jones Drive off of Plymouth, I think you had referred to this earlier. It's called the Tech Brewery, so it's office space for startups and entrepreneurs. This is where Barry Cipher, the Grizzly Peak founder, his company is based. And you can see that one, and it was also a foundry for 50 years, too, so it has this big, ugly smokestack that they preserved. So that wasn't part of the original brewery, but you can tell there's even old ads if you go to the Ann Arbor District Library, which I recommend because it's a really great place, and you can learn a lot. The ads in the 19th century newspapers that the library has thoughtfully digitized and you can see online contain some of these ads for this particular brewery, which had various names throughout the years, and you can still see these hand-drawn, you know, ads that. And hold that next to the building and still see the arches and everything, like, oh, yeah, you know, it is that place. So we're really blessed. I was talking to other local beer history authors, and a couple guys down in New Orleans put one together for New Orleans, and you want to talk about history, you'd figure, well, New Orleans is thick with it. And yet, most of the buildings, the old breweries in New Orleans have been bulldozed. So we're really blessed here to be able to still see the history around us.
So in putting together the book, what is one story that you have not shared yet? One of your favorite little side trails, rabbit holes that came up in researching and interviewing everybody for this?
Well, there were a lot of funny little news items about Mr. So-and-so was caught being drunk in public and hurling beer bottles or something and fined $5 by Judge So-and-so. And I wanted to sprinkle some of those in there to give a flavor of the times, but it really didn't kind of work out. But there were so many of those that I made notes of when I was going through the 19th century newspapers. And one of my favorite stories is more recently and involves Arbor Brewing, and I did want to mention this, but it just didn't fit in anywhere, so it ended up on the cutting room floor. But if you ever see Matt and Renee around town, ask them about how Arbor Brewing used to be haunted. That was a very interesting story, but there wasn't really anywhere to put it logically in the book, so I didn't tell that story. But it's a good one, and I don't know, do you want me to relate it
I would
here?
Love, I've heard from people who work there and go into the basement that it's one of the creepiest basements. There's just an aura, not a good aura,
yeah,
an aura down there.
Yeah, I've only been into the part where they actually, you know, age their sour beers today, which is, I think, a very nice place. But yeah, apparently back in the early part of the 20th century, a policeman was murdered in one of those basements. And I believe it was the basement that used to be, you know, have the reputation of being haunted. And as Matt and Renee tell it, lots of people who work there at the time will attest to strange things happening, and they're kind of the typical haunt stuff, like, you know, water turning itself on, lights flickering, noises, etc. And even Matt, who, you know, doesn't believe in such things, would see stuff out of the corner of his eye. And strangely enough, the way it ended was there was some kind of crew, and they couldn't remember what show it was with, but some TV crew came out, some ghost show or something, wanted to talk about the haunting of Arbor. Of course, when they were there, nothing happened, but, you know, Matt and Renee told the story on camera. And then at some point, this is again from Matt, they all got together and got a kind of a group photo of the staff and everybody that the crew took. And then when they saw the picture later, they saw like a ghostly face that was in the picture, but he was clearly like non-corporeal. And he looked like he had a mustache and all that, and it apparently matches the description of this police officer. Ooh. If you believe that sort of thing.
You're listening to Ann Arbor Ghost Stories here.
Yeah.
No, that's a creepy story.
And he says after that crew came, the haunting ended, and nobody ever saw anything scary again.
Ooh.
And that was around 2000. And my theory was that, well, he was listening in to them tell this story, the ghost, and he said, oh, crap, I'm dead. Poof, then he vanished. Isn't that what happens? Then you have to go to the light or something?
Sure. I saw Poltergeist.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly how it happens.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a great history. Again, the book is Ann Arbor Beer, A Hoppy History of Treetown Brewing. David's also got his blog where you can check out regular updates as well as with the Ann Arbor News. The blog is annarborbeer.com.
Awesome. Easy to remember.
Easy to remember. Thank you so much for coming. And
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I hope you enjoyed this.
Yeah, let's go get a beer.
Sounds good.
All right.